I would like to introduce Richard, our second speaker.
Hi, my name is Richard. I'm an addict.
Hi, Richard.
Thank you for all being here, and thank you for the opportunity to share. I'm very emotional. And that was why it was lovely to listen to Louisa being emotional as well. It helps me to be who I am. I'll just fill you in on my background. I was born in 1947. I grew up on a council estate in Tunbridge Wells. My dad was a postman. And when I was five, my mum had a nervous breakdown. And there's a lot of stuff around that that is very distressing. So much of my history came to me when I got clean. You know, I spent most of my life, I think, running away from enormous amounts of this stuff. And I was saying to someone just now, you know, we have this fabulous opportunity here to examine our lives and to reflect on our lives and to change the behaviour that has come about because of a lot of the things that has happened to us and a lot of our histories. And that's true for me. And very early in my recovery, within a few months, I had a dream in which I was spinning in a spiral downwards. And I woke up, and my then partner said I was talking in strange voices. And the voices were all about experiences I'd had as children that I had just pushed down for so many years. And within that, what these experiences were that I was living with a mentally ill mother for most of my childhood, and that my father gave me the responsibility when I was about five to spend a lot of time taking care of my mother. And then and because, you know, as a child, you just, you know, it's a privilege, really, I thought, to do this. And but I struggled with it, and I found it very, very difficult because I couldn't do it. But then he had to work, you know, and there wasn't a lot of money around, and, you know, so we struggled on. And when I was 8, 9 years old, I saw Singing in the Rain on TV. And, when I saw Gene Kelly dancing in the rain, it was the most magical thing I think I'd ever seen. And I thought, oh my God, I want to be a dancer. And, you know, in the 50s, you don't, as a working class child, you do not say you want to be a dancer. For the obvious reasons. And I was kind of shamed, really, about that. So what I did was I used to go to the woods on my own, and I used to take my clothes off, and I used to dance. And I got caught by a bunch of boys, and I got badly beaten up. And then adding to this tragedy, this difficulty, it got quite serious, and a few of the boys got very frightened by this one particular boy who was being very brutal. And I was left, and I was discovered by two men, and I thought that they were going to take care of me. And in fact, they raped me. And I struggled out of that wood with a few bits of clothing. And my greatest fear was that my mum could kill me, that my mum would go berserk. And so I didn't go home. What I did was I went to the edge of the wood and I sat and I waited. And my dad found me. And I think there were police, I'm not sure. But, you know, I was also, you get threatened about, don't tell anyone, you know, if you do, we'll come and find you and all that stuff. Anyway, the major thing was that my dad took me home, my mother went berserk. And she said it was all my fault, I was to blame. And my dad had to literally force her out of the room to shut her up. And I think that, being blamed and being told that it was all my fault, was in some ways worse, because I never told them what happened. I mean, it must have been obvious what happened, but I never was able to say anything about it. And my mother said, you have shamed the family, you know, your grandmother must never find out, and all of that stuff. So I think, now, I don't know, because I've looked at it to a certain degree, and there's nothing I can find out now because my parents are dead, and there isn't anyone in my family that would know about any of this. So I've kind of now worked a lot on it in my recovery, and I've kind of been able to put it away, but I'll come back to that, because it's quite magical, really, a lot of what happens within this fellowship. So I put that away, and I read. And I don't know whether it was the same time, but I remember being in bed, and I'm pretty sure it was that summer, and it took me a long time to get well. And I just ate books. I just had them piled up on my... And I just kept throwing them at my mum, go to the library, get me more. And I just read and read and read. And to this day, I still have a pile of books by the side of my bed that, you know, I just... It was just... And I called it eating. And And several times in recovery, I've been in the position where... I remember coming out of a relationship after 7 years, and I just picked up thrillers, and I just read and read and read. I just, you know, again, it's like eating. I was like eating these thrillers just to kind of keep the distress at bay. You know, that was my first. So that was my first addiction. My story then goes into next obsession. My next big thing was that I knew also at that age that I wanted to go to art college. And we moved to Brighton when I was 12, which was like going to heaven, because Brighton in those days, in that early, late 50s, early 60s, Brighton was just awash with cinemas. And I did a meet round on a Saturday morning, and I get enough money from the meet round that I could run home, have some lunch, and I could get into town, and I could run from one cinema to the next. I could get 3 movies in one Saturday. And I would literally time them. And they were just, you know, it's bliss. It was absolute bliss. But then, and I had to, I also, you know, I only went to secondary modern school. I didn't get my 11 plus, and I went to this terrible Roman Catholic school, which I won't go into now. But anyway, I was told I was pretty stupid, but I was allowed to do my O-levels. And I was told I wouldn't get any, but I had to get 5. So I got 5. The way I describe it is, it's like I'd been holding my breath for all of those years, and I stumbled up the steps of the art college with such relief. And I met people for the first time in my life who were like me. It was like going to heaven. I look on it now, it's like a monastery where you just locked into this place of just, it was just fantastic. And one of the things that happened on that first day was I was a moddy boy. I was an art college mod, you know, like Pete Townsend and all that, and Eric Clapton, all those people, art college mods. And I had a scooter, and on the way back to college on the first day, I had a crash on the scooter. And my very codependent mum was on a bus coming the other way. And she jumped off the bus, came running down the street, grabbed the scooter and said, and she was tiny, my mum, she was a little bird, can't barely hold it up. And she said, I'm taking the scooter, you're getting to college. And I ran to college, and then my guy who became my best friend and who I know to this day, Ian, was waiting at the college, and he said, oh, I saw you were late, I was worried about you. I went to the shop and I've got you paper and pencils. And it was just like, my God, these people are so nice. You know, kindness. Someone showing me some kindness was somehow so alien to me. It was like, so, it was just fantastic. And I had a great time there, but what also happened there was that it was also when my drinking kicked off as well. And I can remember thinking, where are the drugs? Where are the drugs? I almost swore them, but you know, where are they? The people who took the drugs were the painters, the fine artists, and I was a graphic designer, and eventually we found the dope, and eventually found a bit of speed. But that's basically all you could kind of get, you know. Having said that, there was a whole tranche of people in Brighton in those days at a place called the Lorelei. this cafe. In the basement, there were usually needles, and you know, so there was that whole area going on, but it wasn't something that I was in contact with. So those years at the art college, I kind of developed an attachment to getting drunk a lot and associated. I remember one girlfriend I had who was such a total alcoholic, just unbelievable. You know, you look back and think, my God, we were such. Used to get completely, you know, out of. And I didn't. I managed to. I wasn't very popular with the authorities, and apparently, my sister-in-law was the secretary to the principal, and she told me she'd read my report, and it said apparently that I was a subversive influence upon the younger members of the college, and constantly encouraging them to go to parties and enjoy themselves all the time, which could have been, you know, anyway, whatever. There we go. So, and also, you know, that also what entered into this was because I had met people for the first time in my life that I really felt I could have been close with and have had friendships with. I was terrified of losing it. And I would miss opportunities through a kind of codependence. Now, they didn't want me at Brighton and the Art College. And so I was encouraged to apply to St Martin's. Now, I got into St Martin's on my work, and I had to go for the interview. So what did I do? I had lunch with someone before the meeting, before the interview, and then I got a bit drunk. So I went to the interview drunk and didn't answer any of the questions properly and deliberately just screwed it up. Because I did not, you know, want to leave these people. So, you know, here was, I mean, it would have been amazing. And also it was frightening, you know, I would leave, go. Anyway, the point being, I can look back now and see just how I missed fantastic opportunities because of this illness, because of feeling, you know, this stuff really is just woven into everything, and it was already, you know, working its way through. Anyway, I left, and also I loved music, I still do, and I was, you know, so I got. We were told at Arclis, you leave, you get your first job, doesn't matter what it is. And you stay there for a year. Well, I got a job working for the John Lewis Partnership in Holloway Road, and I used to commute from Brighton. Anyway, I did that for a year, and then I left, and then I saw a tiny advert in one of those trade papers for a record company that wanted an assistant art director. And it was so tiny, this, I thought, it can't be anybody. And anyway, I went along, and it was Polydor. And in those days, Polydor was Atlantic, Electra, I mean, it was really big. And this Scots guy, I was the first one to be interviewed. He was really not bothering anybody else. He said, yeah, all right, you can have the job. So anyway, I got this job in a record company. And he was a complete alcoholic. It ended up like this. The day ended up like this. I would get in at 9:30. I would get all the work done by 11:30, including his. He would then roll in. We would then go to the pub at 12. We'd stay there till 3. We'd come back via the off-licence to get a bottle of whiskey. And then I would end up in meetings completely reeling and somehow deal with these situations. Anyway, I won't. There's a Bee Gees story, but I won't go into that. So then we would then go out at night until early in the morning. I would then take him home to South London, put him to bed, and then I lived in Hampstead. I would then go all the way home to Hampstead, you know, and then the next day would be the same thing all over again. Anyway, I had friends who were, you know, I had groups of friends that I'd been at college with that we all knew, you know, and that we got this whole group of us. Anyway, some others worked at another record company, and they asked me to go and work there, and it was that was WEA, which was Warner Electro Atlantic in those days, which was, you know, an amazing job to go and get. I mean, it was quite incredible. I was 23, completely out of my depth. I had not, you know, I was really, it was amazing. But what I did was, I moved from drink to drugs, because I won't say who, but people used to come in. There was a guy who worked there, a guy called Derek Taylor, and he had this huge office, And he used to sit in the corner, and he had all these people come in. And I remember sitting there, and people would come in, and they'd walk around with handfuls of pills, and they'd look at you and go, oh, I think you need one of those, and you need one of those. And that was then the changeover. And then what happened was that, that all ended in a bit of tears, because But I then worked really hard. We set up a business in Covent Garden. I worked really hard. And at the age of 25, 26, I was becoming a bit too successful. And I kind of panicked. And also I had this dream from being... My father was Canadian. And I had this dream of going to America. And I'd been briefly to New York. Anyway, I saved up some money and I went to New York. And the reason I went to New York was to use... because I left everything behind me, and I spent nearly 2 years in New York using. But then having said that, it was an amazing time. It was the late, mid-70s. I mean, this is the flavour of my time. I knew this woman, and I started talking to her boyfriend who worked at the Museum of Modern Art. Said, I've heard about this club downtown. We'll go and check it out. And when we went down, there was empty. And there were two bands came on. And one was the Talking Heads and one was the Ramones. And it was empty. And, you know, within a few months, you couldn't move in that place. And I went there one night. By this time, I used to have a box with acid in it. And I used to just eat acid all day long. And I remember going to the door completely, you know, out of my head, and people trying to get in. And they just said, oh, yeah, no, it's all right, it's him, come on. And they would just drag me in, you know. And people just knew me as this kind of lunatic Englishman. And so it was very exciting. But I also had friends there. My friend Anya, she was heroin addict. And she just kept me away from it. She said, you're not touching heroin. If you do, you'll be with an addict within 5 minutes. You know, but everything else, you know, I was taking. What were some of the things? Angel dust. I was talking to angels on the roof of a building one night. Angel dust, and there was something called green. I don't think we ever had that one. I think anyway, we won't go into all of that. Anyway, so suffice to say, you know, I came back. My friend, I lived on the Lower East Side between Avenues A and B, which everyone here thought was like hell on earth, but actually it was like Notting Hill. I mean, it was perfectly fine. Anyway, so I came back to London, and then the next 10 years was a kind of slow sort of slide. Having said that, you know, my work, and I love my work, was extraordinary. I mean, it was completely free. Because what I would do, the way I ended up was that I'd have some coke, some heroin, and a bottle of vodka. And I would consume that and draw. And then I'd end up passed out, drooling on the desk. And then I'd go home, and I'd come back the next day, and I would look at all this stuff, and I would pull out of it images. Although my wife, I was married by this time, my wife did say that it's just drug-induced madness, that's your imagery, but anyway, which was true. But I was married, and I'm sad about that marriage, because I know I was incapable of love, really, but there was... I look back with sadness because there was a lot of good things about it. And she put up with, you know, a lot of seriously bad behaviour on my part. And I wasn't, you know, my focus was on using. It wasn't on anything. I wasn't interested in finding anyone else for sex. I wasn't interested in that sort of thing. I would hang out with my dealer just all the time. And, you know, and I'd get him out of bed at 10 o'clock in the morning. And my day would run, you know, wake up, go in, get him out of bed, go to the bank, talk the bank manager into giving me some money. I'd walk around the corner, and there's a pub around the corner, and I would walk in, and the man would look at me and nod, I'd nod, and he'd put a double vodka on the thing, and I'd throw that back, and I'd get in the car, I'd go up, get some drugs, get my coke, and then I'd have a little guy who would get me the heroin, and I would then get those together, and I'd use that during the day, and then I'd have a sleep in the afternoon, and then I'd get about and do it again. And that was my life. And then, in the end, we got to the point where my wife just kicked me out. And I then started a relationship with this woman who was a friend of ours, Dizzy. And we came into recovery together. I want to really get on with a bit of recovery because I'm running down. So in 1990, I came into recovery with Dizzy and I, and she went to Al-Anon, and I started off in AA meetings. It took me a year to get clean, but what I did was I just kept coming to meetings every day, and I just had, it was a bit of coke was the last thing I had. Also, that time, I'm fearful of you thinking I'm not seriously an addict enough. I think I should try and drop that. I'm just going to say, oh, crack was just coming in. We had a bit of that. Anyway, I started, and we had a reunion thing the other day with one of us who was 20, and I was 20 a few months or so ago. And we had this lovely strong group, about five or six of us, and we used to go to meetings together all the time. And I used to, and then was, as Louisa was saying, you know, I had this sponsor, and I used to go to this meeting, and he just used to say, oh, you're a greeter now, and just push me out the front. And exactly, you know, like it's been said. And we did the steps, and, you know, it was okay. But then when I got to about... and then Dizzy and I split up, and I started a relationship with this woman, Sally, and we thought we were doing all the right things, dealing with all the codependents, dealing with all the love addiction, dealing with all the going to SLAR, doing all the right things. And I just thought there's something wrong, I'm not quite sure, and I went and did Big Book Study Group, which was fantastic. I do like discipline. I do like structure. And it was lovely because you go along every week and say, step four, right, we're going to do it, and we did it. And it was like, you don't argue. You don't. I used to get so annoyed with people questioning it. It's like, what are you questioning it for? Just do it. Anyway, we did it, and it was fantastic. And it was a joke. I thought I was being really clever by writing down just about the name of everyone on the planet on my resentment list. It was absolutely massive. I thought, ooh, you know. And then they said, okay, now you've got to write about every single person you've written down. It's like, oh, and it was endless. But you know, it's like a mantra, isn't it? You're writing down the same thing over and over and over again. So I did that, and I'm really, you know, that. So that was my second time through the steps. And then Sally and I, we were together 5 years, and we decided to live together. And then we had a daughter, my daughter Edie, who's now 8. Sorry, I get emotional because she's just amazing. But about 15, 16 years within the relationship, I got seriously suicidally depressed to the point where the doctors offered me a place in hospital. And a friend of mine in this fellowship said, I know exactly where you are. I'm coming to get you. And she took me to a SLAR Howe meeting. Now, it says in one of the readings at the beginning here about being, you know, honest, open and willing. And basically all that the SLAR Howe thing does is a very disciplined, focused way of doing the steps around relationships and one's relationship with oneself. And learning really It's not, you know, do you know it's not learning? It's somehow or other being able to put oneself in the position of being given a gift by God that takes, that enables one to love oneself. And that is what is the most incredible thing about where I find myself today. Because I can honestly say that for the first time, I mean, there's one guy who I hadn't seen for ages, and I saw him not long ago, and he said, "I thought you were going to be depressed for the rest of your life." He said, "It's amazing to see how you have, you know, what has happened." And it really isn't to do with me. And, you know, so I unfortunately, as a result of the process of doing that, I had to come out of that relationship, which is sad. And what I, you know, one of the things you, that I say is, you know, or we say, one doesn't write one's own life. If one could write one's own life, it certainly wouldn't be the life that I've had. These things happen and circumstances rise up and we do the best we can with what is around us. And I left that relationship, but I have my daughter. I have my daughter on Wednesdays. I have that she's being looked after by my new partner tonight, who's babysitting her for the first time. I have her tomorrow. And I ring her twice a day, and she lives around the corner. And I've been at school today, doing service at school for my daughter, selling Christmas cards to raise money so they can go to the theatre, which I really enjoyed. So I find myself in this position where I can say to you that I am happy. I feel very grateful. I feel that my life is abundant. And I'll qualify that, okay, abundance, with the irony of it or the whatever, is that recently I was bankrupted for the second time in recovery. I was bankrupted when I first came in. And I've just happened to me again. And I won't go again, I won't go towards Jesus. I am useless with money. I'm just completely... It confuses me. I can't do it. As soon as I think about money, my head spins. I've been to DA, I've done all the DA, you know, and I write the figures down and I blurred and I do my best. But I have to say, you know, I'm not living on an overdraft at the moment. So the Inland Revenue got fed up with me and they said, "We're going to bankrupt you." Okay, fine. So anyway, they have done. They're not going to get any money, and there we go. So I only owe money to the Inland Revenue and banks. So there were no individuals involved. Although I suppose in the greater scheme of things, one is being irresponsible by not paying the tax. But anyway, so here I am today with, I've split up from my partner. They have the flat. They have all the bits in the flat. They have the car. And I laugh because I don't have a bed. I don't own a bed. I don't own a TV. I don't have a car. But actually, I have to say, there is a lot of choice in this, actually. And, you know, well, that's what I want to say, really. I really don't care. I really don't. It really doesn't bother me. I just feel so good. And so kind of content. Now, this morning I was feeling a bit rough. Now, the reason I was feeling a bit rough this morning, because I was tired. And one of the biggest things, you know, that affects us is that dreadful thing, HALT. You know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. It is so powerful. And it's not some, you know, I had, within the darkness of the depression that I had a few years ago, I had started with a new therapist, and she was somebody who was 20 years clean and who, was absolutely brilliant. And, sorry, I've lost my thread there. Just going back to being happy, joyous and free. I mean, oh, God, doesn't that sound horrible? I mean, I really, you know, I have spent years saying this doesn't work. You know, 12-step recovery doesn't work. It's just miserable, ruined. Having been, you know, constantly clean all these years. But it is. But that's what I'd say was just reversing back a minute. To the abuse that happened to me as a child, when I redid the steps recently in the last few years, there was a moment, and a lot of my sexual behaviour was based around a recreation of that abuse, and that fantasy was removed. At the moment that fantasy was removed, somebody from my past turned up that I was at college with, and we're now in a relationship. And to me, it was all like this is all, I believe, is higher power driven. Now, I'm in a relationship with somebody, you know, the relationship I came into recovery in, I was the victim, I was my mother. I then moved into a relationship with this other person where I was my father, I was the rescuer, looking after two children. I'm now in a relationship with somebody who, also the woman, the mother of Edie's mum, was 18 years younger than me. And, you know, when you're looking at this man who's getting old, and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I'm in a relationship with an old man, you know, this is horrible. And she found got a lot of shame about that and found it very difficult. And that obviously exacerbated the whole situation within our relationship. So I'm now in a relationship with somebody who's 2 years younger than me, who also is old, you know, and I look at her and I think, you're an old woman, but then I have to remember I'm an old man. So it's kind of like, well, that equals out. But also, you know, I fancy her like mad. I mean, she's fantastic. It has to be said, when she was young, she was unbelievable, so gorgeous. But anyway, she was my old mate from college. And we are now having this fantastic relationship. And she's not in recovery, but she did live with an alcoholic for 18 years, so she kind of qualified, and she did get better through a different route. And she knows about all, that's the other thing, she knew about all this stuff, was familiar with all this stuff, and was so relieved to find somebody that also knew about all of this stuff, but wasn't using. And so she, you know, she keeps saying, oh, you can take me to an Al-Anon meeting, because I keep saying, well, you're a real Al-Anon, yeah, but anyway. There we go. We'll see what happens. But it is today. I have I really want to just focus on this just for the last few minutes. It's spiritual. This is spiritual. Those things in my life are not removed by me, and I know they're not removed by me. That obsession was not taken away by me. It was just removed. Now I had an image at that particular time I want to share with you. It's as if, imagine a canal, and on the canal is a large boat. And on the boat is my mum and the guys in the woods. And I am dragging that boat down the canal. And I've been dragging that boat down the canal all my life. One day I had an image of turning around, looking at the boat and letting go of the rope and watching that boat go down the line of the canal to where it belongs in my past. And turning around and looking out at an open field and walking into a valley, holding the hand of a child who's a boy and a child who's a girl, and just walking away from that. And that, I think, is the gift, is that I always wanted to walk into that open valley and have that freedom. And I got there. And all I have to do is take responsibility and take care of myself. I get enough sleep, I get enough food, which I'm rubbish at, and just love and take care of myself. Now, I don't get that love by going, oh, I must love myself. I get it from step 11. And step 11 has become the most important step of my life at this particular stage. And I do have, you know, I do one day at a time now these days. If I get up, pray and meditate and do my exercises every morning, and do this heart breathing. I do this breathing love in and out of my heart. And I tell you, it's amazing. It really does work. And it makes my life so much easier. And I'm willing now, and one of the other things that doing the steps recently did to me was it took away my workaholism. Oh, dear. I didn't know I was workaholic. Sally told me I was, because I used to work all the time. And I was constantly tired. And now, oh, bliss. I used to hear about Graham Greene, the writer. Okay. Graham Greene, apparently, used to get up early in the morning and write until lunchtime. And he'd go out with his friends and have lunch, and then he'd go and spend the afternoon with his mistress. And I thought, that sounds perfect. Anyway, that's kind of like my life these days. This is what I do. I get up early, and I do my prayers and meditation, and I get on with my work. And when it comes to lunchtime, I'm tired, so I have a rest. And then I get up, and I do a bit of preparation, or I go and see my daughter, or I see my mistress. That I'm in this relationship, and I don't want to bump into, just in case you bump into us one day. But I am getting things in my life now that are so much better than anything I've ever had. And that, you're looking at a man who is 64, approaching 65, and it's supposed to be downhill. Was it somebody said in a meeting recently? What I've got to look forward to is death. The next great event in my life is death. The trouble is, I've got a horribly niggly feeling. You know, my grandmother was a week after 100, and I got a horrible, horrible feeling. And my daughter said to me the other day, "Daddy, I don't care what you do, just don't die." And she's 8, and she does say to me, you know, "Just don't die, Daddy. Are you going to be around when I get older?" I don't know. Who we don't. But I just got a niggly feeling. What I also draw strength from is, you know, there are people out there, there are guys in their 70s who are... I won't remember his name. Oh, that's... You know, I have all these continuous senior moments, never remember anything. But there's a theatre director out there who's in his 80s and he's still doing, you know... I always use Ridley Scott for some reason, as an example. I mean, Ridley Scott's now in his 70s and he's still directing major movies. So, you know, I'm starting a new business. I have started a new business. It's going to launch, you know, in the next few months. That comes out of... I was given the opportunity to do these books, and I had this kind of ambition that I wanted to do New Age imagery in a new way, and that's kind of what I've done, redefined, kind of, it's all about angels. Anyway, I have all these images, and I'm turning them into something else. And so it's like, I'm not going to get... I can only do so much in a day, and I will do that, and I won't do any more. If I push myself too hard, I get really tired, and then I'm just useless to be around. And I just think it's, again, coming back to this thing about God-given, is if I take care of myself, look after myself, and stay calm, and keep stopping in the day, and breathing, and just calming myself down and being relaxed, then it's going to be okay. It's going to be fine. There is no rush to death. It's fine. It'll be there. It's waiting. It's not a problem. And it doesn't, you know, I just can't tell you how grateful, you know, it's difficult. This whole thing, life is a pain. Sometimes, you know, it's difficult, and it goes up and down, and I wish it wouldn't go up and down, but having got here is quite miraculous to me, because, you know, to have these feelings of contentment and peace and happiness is not something I ever had been able to give myself, and today I can choose to be happy rather than choose to be sad. And I never believed that that was possible. For years, I'd never believed it was possible to make that choice in life. Today, I choose to be happy. I choose not to be sad. And that, for me, is a miracle. And it is. It's God-given. It's not for me. It's just because I do what you have all taught me to do over the last 20 years. And I thank you all very much for that. Thank you.